Members, we'll start. We don't quite have a quorum, but we'll continue on. And we have Ms. Julek and Jolik. I'm sorry. I'll get there. And Dr. Rivers. And I apologize yesterday, Director. We can go. Maybe we'll use Director if you're okay with that. Does that sound better?
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Rivers. Please identify yourself for the records. If you could enunciate carefully, then we'll try and remember as we continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Erica Rivers, Director of Minnesota State Parks and Trails. And I'm just going to pass this over to Ms. Julek to give you an update on one of the handouts that was passed out yesterday.
Welcome, Ms. Julek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Barb Julek, DNR. One of the charts we handed out yesterday, the index, was incomplete on the right, so there's just a replacement like page for you. It's slides 9 and 10 that would go into your slide.
Go ahead, continue.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to continue this morning. Again, thank you for the opportunity to talk about Minnesota State Parks and Trails and our budget and change items this morning. Yesterday, I gave you an overview of the Minnesota State Parks and Trails budget, and today I would like to go through the change items that come from the governor's recommendation. The first major change item is a $9.5 million appropriation for operations and maintenance of Minnesota State Parks. Of that $9.5 million, $7.2 million would come from the general fund, and the recommendation is for the remainder of that $9.5 million to come from increased fees for users of Minnesota State Parks. Those fees would include a $1 increase going from $5 to $6 on the daily entrance fee permit and from $25 to $30 on the annual permit. We anticipate that those fee increases would result in about $1 million in the first fiscal year and $1.3 million in the second fiscal year of this biennium. Over the course of the last decade, Parks and Trails has been managing costs with relatively flat operating dollars. While we have benefited immensely from legacy fund over the course of the last 6 years, our operations funds, those funds that we use to do the basic operations, pay the utility bills, keep the doors open in our state parks, have remained flat. Our operating funds typically come from general fund, our state park revenue account, which I discussed yesterday in the natural resources fund, as well as some lottery and lieu funding also in the natural resources account. So over the course of the same time, we have seen increases in fleet costs, salary, propane, gas, and electricity. And all those costs have had to be absorbed over the flat operating funds during that same period. So we're asking for this increase in general fund as well as a modest increase in the fees in order to do the basic upkeep of our state parks. This would include our cleaning and security, campground services, as well as customer services at the front desk. Without this fee increase, we anticipate we would need to cut about 154,000 hours of customer service staff time within our state parks. This would mean that we would have to go to summer-only camping in all but 5 or 6 of our highest-used parks. We've already cut some off-season camping in about half of our state parks. This would pretty much eliminate the camping in all but those 5 or 6 main parks. Over the course of the last biennium, we have done our best to try to minimize the impacts of this flat funding to our visitors, and have managed to not impact more than about 1% of campers. We have really truly reached the breaking point at this point, and we need to have these fee increases so that we don't start cutting into and start having to make cuts that really will be visible to the general public. And when I say that, when we're talking about camping in particular, we're talking about 40,000 campsite nights that would have to be eliminated. And this really sort of starts cutting into the bone of the state park system. We would start, and the funding mechanism, we would be losing about $3.8 million in revenue from that loss of camping from this budget. We'd also have to close some facilities that we just wouldn't be able to staff anymore and clean and upkeep. Those would include some of our bathroom facilities, some of the visitor centers, picnic shelters, and the like. We would have to probably do some kind of contract for, you know, porta potties and this kind of thing. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Rivers. And I'm curious, what about rethinking how the department delivers camping sites? Do we have opportunities where people can check in, say, out at Apton State Park, and there doesn't have to be an attendant there? Do we sometimes just open it in the morning and then let people come and go, some on their own? Do we do that? I know you have some satellite parks that are the offices at a different park. Should we be doing more of that? Are there opportunities where we can rethink the services we deliver and let the general public know certain times of the year there's one level of service and different times of the year different levels? Director Rivers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's an excellent question. And yes, we have begun down the pathway of a differentiated system where we do exactly that. There would be some satellite parks. I know in Representative Fabian's district, for example, we have three parks that are run from our Lake Bronson Park. And those, we do collect fees in a fee box rather than have an attendant at the park, and the contact station is closed. At that point, I would like to just mention that our budget, starting this year, we will be reconstructing based on this system plan. And this is something that I would love to have an opportunity to talk more in depth about at some point. The system plan is a new approach to state parks. The 2016 biennium, I'm proud to say, will host the 125th anniversary of Minnesota State Parks. It's quite an accomplishment. And my predecessors in this position have done a great job of building an extraordinary state park system. We are the envy of the nation in some ways for this park system. But over those 125 years, as we have built it, we have treated all parks essentially the same way, and we've sort of sprinkled the resources equitably across all of the parts of the state, which has been a good approach for building the system. But as you mentioned, at this point in our history, we need to start thinking about what the special niches of all these park units are and how we invest into the future, both in staff time as well as development of those park systems. And some of them will be more remote park experiences, and people should be expecting excellent remote park experiences. And so our mission here in the coming years is to create and implement this system plan in a way that we create excellent experiences at the one end of the spectrum, which would be those rustic parks, as you mentioned, satellite parks, and really excellent high amenity parks on the other end of the system, which would be those destination parks.
Director Rivers, can you also remind me, the Sudan Mine used to get a huge subsidy in general fund. What's the status of the mine, and how has that changed? Does that no longer have that if it's not operational, which I don't believe it is right now, but maybe it is up and running again, and what is the plan there? Because that used to be the biggest general fund drain on the state park system. Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Sudan Underground Mine and Lake Vermilion State Park were combined into one park last year, and so we're now running that as Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park. And it's a long name. Is that what you're laughing about? And Sudan Mine tours are, in fact, operational at this point. We do have a net revenue loss at Sudan Underground Mine, or Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine, of about $1 million a year. It is a very expensive operation to run. As you know, there is also a U of M cooperative agreement there for an underground physics lab that we generate a little bit of revenue from that lease payment. But it is an expensive operation to run. Having said that, I'll also say that it's one of the most extraordinary experiences in our state park system. It's unique in the country, one of the only places in the country that you can ride an authentic 1930s hoist down into an underground mine that is a historic district underground. You ride a train underground throughout that mine, and there are just an incredible, unforgettable experience for Minnesotans to go to. So. Again, I'll hearken back to my comments yesterday, which is that Minnesota State Parks are a public service. They're a public good. I don't think they were designed with being budget neutral. They're a public service, much like libraries, much like our schools. It's something that increases quality of life in the state of Minnesota, and that comes with a price tag.
And Director Rivers, do we have the spreadsheet that shows the cash flow for all the individual parks? If I remember right, only a couple. Is that included in our packet here? And aren't there only a couple with positive cash flow? Is that still the case?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we have provided this committee with answers to the questions from Assistant Commissioner Meyer's presentation several weeks ago, and that was sent to the committee by Mr. Rivers sometime last week, and we did provide a spreadsheet of the cash flow from all those parks. To your question about how many of them have positive cash flow, back in 2010 when we did this analysis, there were about 8 parks. I'm happy to report there are now 18 parks that are net cash flow. But that is still only a fraction of our system where state parks are having net neutral or positive cash flow.
Thank you. Continue.
That's all I had on the state parks. If there are no questions, I'll move on to the snowmobile change item.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Rivers, you're talking about a fee increase for parks.
Mm-hmm.
So is that just to maintain the level that you're currently at? Just, I want to be clear on that.
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, yes, that is correct. It would be to maintain the existing customer services that we have in our parks. I would like to just caveat that by saying, though, we have run this system in a very similar fashion over the course of probably about 2 decades. And again, our new system plan, we are planning to implement a different, more differentiated system into the future. Some of that's already underway because of the co-located and co-managed facilities across our system. We've already started down that path. But this system plan does make explicit that there will be some parks in our system that we will run as rustic parks. There will be some that will be core destination type parks. And there will be some that will be, you know, high quality destination facilities with lots of amenities. But we're going to be a lot more explicit about where those locations are and how we invest into the future.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you going to give us the outline of which parks are going to be designated in which way before we pass a budget?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, representative members, yes, we can do another presentation if you like, or the system plan is in fact on our website at this point, where and we have the system plan designations for the state parks as well as state trails. The state trails are broken into segments, actually, so you could have one designated state trail that would have multiple segments. Some of them would be destination segments, some would be partner-led segments, some would be DNR segments. We've also done the same with the forest recreation areas, as well as started down that path on public water access sites as well.
Director Rivers, if you can coordinate with Committee Administrator Zipko on getting that information to us, and then we'll provide it.
Absolutely.
All of them, including if you could give us a little more information on the history included in that on the Sudan mine. And members, if you have any questions about the Sudan mine, we actually have a citizen of Minnesota that lives within about a mile of the mine, Mr. Tammon, who is in our committee almost every day with his wife. I hope she's feeling okay. I don't see her today in the audience. She's under the weather. He's shaking his head no. So that's unfortunate. I know a lot of people are right now. But he actually lives within a mile of the Sudan underground mine. And having experienced that, it is really something. But it's also important for members to know it has $1 million subsidy from the general fund to operate that experience. And so it is by far the single most expensive park experience that we have. And there is a underground University of Minnesota lab in place there. They pay some money, but this committee will visit that relationship and make sure that our Parks Department is being treated fair. Are you done, Representative Fabian? Additional follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Director Rivers, what communications or what discussions have you had with county boards and so forth with regards to your plan as you move forward?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian and members, we have had a 2-year extensive input process, both with our staff internally as well as connected stakeholders within each of the regions. Minnesota DNR manages, as Commissioner Landwehr mentioned all of our facilities in four different regions. We've had conversations both at the very beginning of the planning process all the way through those 18 months with local communities. I also just did want to point out, Ms. Zipko did hold up this document that we have. This is the one that we handed out. We call our Parks and Trails 101 document, and I had forgotten that we actually have a map on the second page of that document that highlights which parks and trails are in which categories based on the system plan. So that information is available to you. We'll make sure that you have copies of the system plan as well for your committee.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, I'm asking, for example, at the Old Mill State Park, has the DNR had personal contact and sit down with the Marshall County Board of Commissioners?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I am not sure. We'll have to do some follow-up with the regional manager in that area to know who he has actually talked to about these specific designations. Also, just a further to that question, we have created the basic scaffolding, we believe now, through these 18 months of conversations. At this point, then, we need to actually start thinking about how the budget rolls out into and gets distributed throughout the system based on these different designations. And so we're getting a team together now to move forward and working directly with park staff and local communities to help people understand and help have that conversation about what does it mean to be a rustic park in Northwest Minnesota, in particular, in your case, the example of Old Mill, for example. What does it mean for natural resources conservation? What does it mean for the visitor services that are provided? How are we going to manage that park into the future and collect fee revenue? As well as how are we going to be staffing that facility? Will it be mostly on weekends? Will it be on high-volume weekends? And that sort of thing. So that's really the next step in the planning process is the implementation of the plan. And this will be a several years process, and it will evolve over time.
Thank you. Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Rivers, could you give us a brief update on our newest state park, Vermilion, there, in terms of what's available? And also, do you have any major capital expenditures planned for that park this year?
Mm-hmm. Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm happy to say that Lake Vermilion State Park, Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park, is in development phase right now. We have one day-use area already open. It's accessible by the lake. It has been accessible by the lake for a couple of years. It is also now very happily accessible by road. The main state park road was developed in last year, and so it's a beautiful state park drive. This fall was just really beautiful, knock your socks off with the gorgeous weather and leaf color. This coming spring, we are planning to break ground on the campground, and we're really excited about that. The design is complete. It's going out for bid, so that we will be opening a campground at Lake Vermilion within the next 18 months.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Rivers. I'm assuming we'll be seeing a bonding package come forth from the agency. Is that correct?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, that's correct.
Representative Hansen.
And I'd just like to put in a plug for asset preservation. It's good to be enhancing the new park. We need to get that going. But I think a few years ago we created a program like HEPR that we have for higher education. So we're not determining which trail needs updating or which building at which park needs updating. There's that asset preservation for natural resources. So just I would encourage a big number there for the needs are what we see kind of constant in both the trail system and in the parks. And just I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, this committee did request information, which we have provided, and in that information, I believe Representative Dill asked for a long-term facility maintenance plan for Minnesota State Parks and Trails. That information is provided in that document, And we have broken out, what we asked our development staff to do is to take a 25-year view of what kind of rehab is needed in the state park and trail system and amateurize that out over the 25 years. The number is in fact rather large. It's $58 million a year for 25 years to upgrade all of the facilities that we have within the system right now over that period of time. So I hope that hopefully that information is helpful to you. We're also undertaking within the division something we call the Project Prioritization Framework, where our regional and local state park and trail managers are prioritizing which facilities are in the greatest need, both from safety as well as customer service. And those are being scored and ranked within that project prioritization framework. And so we can actually take that then, overlay it onto this 25-year asset preservation need and put the highest priorities on the top. To that end, what we have done on this document that we've provided to you is, in this 25-year plan, we've given you the highest priority examples of projects that need attention. We've also outlined which projects have dedicated funding sources to them. And by dedicated, I mean we've already have placeholders in, let's say, the 14-15 bonding bill for asset preservation, those that we are using in the taking care of what we have pillar of the legacy funds, and those that currently don't have a funding source identified.
Follow-up, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that report. Is it available on your website so that the public could see it, or could it be shortly?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is not currently on our website. It could be put there if you want.
It looks like Representative Hanson nodded yes, so if that works for your department, that'd be great. Continue on. We are trying to move ahead, so if you could go through the trail part, I'm assuming next. Mm-hmm. Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, members, our second change item highlighted through the governor's budget is a one-time change to the snowmobile trail operations. We are requesting $450,000 appropriated from the snowmobile account. This funding would be used to provide upkeep and maintenance grooming on snowmobile trails that are managed by the department. Without this funding, one-time funding appropriation, we would have to have less grooming and maintenance on those trails. Currently, as I mentioned yesterday, about 60% of the snowmobile fund is through grant and aid, goes out through grant and aid projects or programs throughout the state with our immense volunteer network of grant and aid snowmobile clubs that help maintain the 22,000 miles. Of that, however, about 900 miles do not currently get maintained with clubs. Some of those are really key connection points with other communities that lead to these trails. And so we really need this $450,000 one-time appropriation to maintain those state trails. Any questions on that? I'll move forward. The last three of these change items. Apparently there's a question, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Representative Hackworth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question is, if this is a one-time appropriation for this activity, has there been a previous amount allotted to this activity?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, could you clarify that question for me?
Representative Hackworth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're asking for $450,000 out of the dedicated account for this activity to maintain these state trails, apparently, or grant aid trails that are not being taken care of. What were these trails being taken care of before in the previous budget, and how much was that appropriation if that was the case? Or is this something new?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbar, thank you for that clarification. This was previously covered in the existing appropriation. We have seen a rise in costs over the course of several years, the last several years, including compensation costs to staff as well as an aging grooming fleet, so that we had to make some investments there as well.
Director Rivers, I would encourage you to work with Representative Hackbar and Representative Dill, so they both have a comfort level in what's going on with this account and where we're at. Is that what we're looking for, Representative Hackbarth?
Thank you.
Okay. I want to make sure there are snowmobile people that know this account, and we want to make sure they're comfortable. And I think Representative Hackbarth is a little surprised, so I would have been better, I think, if they would have been contacted ahead of time. Continue on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, we have been working with MinUSA on our snowmobile accounts. We will definitely work with Representative Hackbarth to make sure he has a comfort level with this change item.
Okay, thank good. You I'm glad much. You have contacted MinUSA. Mm-hmm. Continue on.
So the last three change items, Mr. Chair, the last three change items relate to the legacy fund. This is a standard appropriation that the governor makes. This is based on a 40-40-20 split. Members of the committee, many of you are aware of a dedicated or the legacy funding working group back met several years ago after some, I would say, tumultuous times within this committee and the legacy committee to help find a path forward with collegiality and working together on the distribution of the legacy funds with a clear eye to providing a really well-integrated, connected system of state parks and trails throughout the state. Through that working group, we reached an agreement, a consensus, to follow a 40-40-20 split. That 40-40-20 would be 40% to Minnesota State Parks and Trails, 40% to the Metropolitan Council, and 20% to the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails System. So the governor is recommending here a appropriation from the legacy account of 40%, which we would divide that 40% in the DNR State Parks and Trails accounts into the four pillars of the legacy account. Those four pillars were identified and defined in the 25-year legacy plan, which has an enormous amount of stakeholder input 6 years ago. We've highlighted on this slide several of the things that we would like to accomplish with that 40%. We have also provided a report on the legacy our intentions of how to spend this legacy money with another report. Just hold this up for your reference. This has also been distributed to the chairs and the committees. This is our legacy report. The last page of that legacy report does list all the projects we intend to accomplish using this appropriation. I did present testimony in the legacy committee last week on this. If we have further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Continue on.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this second change item related to legacy really has to do with the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Commission and the Greater Minnesota System. This is a 20%. The 20% flows through Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. As many of you know, the Greater Minnesota Coalition has become very organized over the last biennium. We're very happy to report that. They have a system plan that they have begun to implement and have identified their highest priority regional parks and trails of significance. This expenditure would be about a little over $8 million, I think 8.5 the first year and 8.9 the second year, to implement and fund projects in Greater Minnesota. Any questions on that one? And then the final change item is the collaboration with partners. This is over the course of the last 2 years, the Parks and Trails Legacy Advisory Committee has made some recommendations to the three implementing agencies. And again, those are the Minnesota DNR, the Metropolitan Council, and Greater Minnesota Commission to do some more coordinated work. So this appropriation would be an off-the-top appropriation from the legacy fund, about $500,000 each year. Some very exciting things are happening with this coordination that I think are a real testament to what the legacy fund has done for coordinating this seamless system of state parks and trails across the state. One of the projects we're working on is an integrated web-based system, integrated digital information. What that means in plain terms is that Metropolitan Council, Greater Minnesota, and DNR, we're all counting things differently. And this is an opportunity to actually start counting things in the same way and then be able to provide our customers and visitors to the state of Minnesota with seamless information about how you connect different trails and different outdoor recreational amenities in all of the state systems. The other really exciting project that falls under this category is research. Again, getting back to the counting of things, Metropolitan Council was counting their visitorship in one way, DNR was counting it in another, Greater Minnesota wasn't counting it at all. So this is a path forward to actually create standardized research across the three systems so that, again, we can fund and allocate resources across all of these systems in the most optimal way.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Rivers, I'd like to go back. Well, first of all, in that third change item, the acquisition of 40 additional park acres, we're having discussions with members about having a hard time meeting our budgets, maintaining what we have. Help me out here. Why do we need to acquire more? When we seem to be having a very difficult time maintaining what we have, and we're going to ask the people of the state of Minnesota to kick in more money.
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the 40-acre parcel that's described on this slide is a 40-acre parcel within Jay Cook State Park. All of our acquisitions within the parks right now are within statutory boundaries of state parks. I mentioned yesterday we have about 175,000 acres of state park land that has been designated through statute. Of that, there's about 40,000 acres of those parks within or land within those state parks that are not yet acquired. So this is a private in-holding in Jay Cook State Park. It will provide visitor access to the west end of that park. It's an outstanding parcel for natural resource management as well as recreation. So that's why that would be included as an acquisition in the legacy.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then if I could go back to the first change item, talking about reconstructing 900 acres of native plant communities. Is that on currently held state land or is that on private land?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's correct. It is within state park boundaries.
Representative Fabian.
That's good. Thank you.
I think you are done, Director Rivers.
Thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate your support.
Thank you. We're glad to have you on board, and I think the DNR made a good move. Thank you. Next, we have Division of Lands and Minerals, Mr. Richards. Members, I'd like like to move the minutes of February 4th. Representative Heinzman.
I make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Members, I would ask you to mention, or just want to mention, unfortunately, both Representative Green and Representative Poppy lost a parent recently, and they, I don't think, will be here all week, if I understand. And unfortunate, both of them, you know, are rural members, so please keep their family in your thoughts and prayers. Welcome, Director. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Jess Richards, Director of Lands and Minerals for the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today. As you know, the Lands and Minerals Division is charged with managing about over 12 million acres of state-owned mineral rights for the benefit of all Minnesotans. And we do this through managing mineral leasing, exploration, mine development, and also through permitting to ensure environmentally sound mineral development and also to make sure that mine lands are reclaimed for future use. We also, the other half of our division, manages the real estate services for the 5.5 million acres of state-owned land. And we handle everything from leasing of hunting shacks to processing acquisitions to the sale of surplus state lands. Fully staffed, the Lands and Minerals Division is about 90 to 95 people. We have a little over half of those located in greater Minnesota in our offices in Hibbing, the regional offices in Bemidji, Brainerd, Grand Rapids, New Ulm, and then the remainder in St. Paul. This is just a shot of one of our staff working in our core library in Hibbing. And, you know, as you know, the Minnesota is number 3 overall in the United States for non-fuel mineral production. And Minnesota generates 80% of the first pour of the raw material for first pour steel in the United States. So I just want to share with you just some outcomes from the Lands and Minerals Division before I get into some of the funding. In 2014, we had record mineral revenues over $70 million, and this eclipsed the last record by $20 million, and it was primarily a result of more mining of state-owned ore and also the result of good negotiated lease terms on behalf of the state. This money goes to primarily to schools, local taxing districts, and the university system. We issued about 6 permit amendments in the last year, and the biggest, of course, was MINTAC expansion for 450 acres at the MINTAC facility near Virginia. And over the past 2 years, we've overseen the reclamation of over 10,000 acres of previously mined lands. On the real estate side of things, we completed about 140 acquisitions in 2014. We sold 100 acres of surplus state land in fiscal year 2014, but in the last 6 months, we've sold an additional 290 acres. The division also has been real instrumental in the implementation of strategic land asset management for the department.
Director Richards, excuse me. Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, just a question. What's the formula for determining what a surplus land is?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, we go through a process to determine which lands should be offered for sale. It's a lengthy process that goes on with our area offices and all the different divisions, as well as the Lands and Minerals Division. And there's not a per se formula, but what they do is they look at a couple things. First of all, we'll look at what kind of land is it. For example, is it school trust land? If it's school trust land, what's the highest and best use for that trust land? Is it got mineral potential? Should it be retained for potential mineral value? Has it got good forestry potential? Should it be held for forest production? If it doesn't have any of those things, is the best option for the trust to sell it? And so we look at that kind of thing. We also look at what's the market for sale at that time. Is it something we should look at selling at this time? And we also then go through a process of looking at isolated parcels across the state to see if there's a way to sell some of those parcels so that we don't have distributed lands all over the place. So if you've got a 40 acres that's just sitting out in the middle of nowhere, you know, is that something that we should really hold on to? So we go through that process annually, and our regions and our divisions then get together through strategic land asset management every spring, and that's happening in April, to review parcels for sale, parcels that they'd like to acquire, that sort of thing.
Follow up, Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me an idea of just what the success ratio then is of the sales? Have there been, is there land out there that has been on the market for some time? What I'm driving at, it seems to me that a lot of the land that goes up for sale is land that really has very little value. And I'm trying to drill down as to that. It seems like we're very eager to acquire land. But in northern Minnesota, where I come from, I'm concerned about the loss of private land, and I would like to see valuable private or private public land where it does not fit the needs of the state to return to private acquisition where we could actually get some tax base to our local governments. But so the success ratio on the sale of the land would be a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hancock. And Director Richards, I'm going to ask you to come back with Mr. Vandalin, who's the school trust person with the DNR. I don't know if his title has changed yet or not. But I need both of you to come back. I need you to do some homework. And I kind of jumped up when you talked about the sale of 100 or 200 acres. I'm sorry. If we're going to buy thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of acres across Minnesota, which I like doing, we got to start selling a lot more up north where it needs to be sold. So you're going to have to come in here and be on the hot seat with a plan where we're getting real. We got Lakeshore and Lake Vermilion that school trust owned. That we should be putting on the market and letting people build homes on it. It's not in the best interest of the school trust. We've got land in Representative Fabian's district that potentially area farmers now think they have an interest in. We need to move forward because we're at a challenging spot here, and and I look forward to you moving this forward. So if you could work with the northern delegation of this committee and see what kind of questions they have. But Representative Dill, Representative Hancock, Representative Fabian have come back, and their patience is waning in some of the other things that we are doing in this committee. So thank you. This is a very serious issue, and we need some attention to it. So comment, Representative Hancock, did you have additional comments? Director Richards, you understand that? If you could just put that on the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, understood. We will make sure to come back, and we'll work with the committee to come up with the kind of detail that you're looking for. One note is in the last 6 months, or actually in the last 2 years, we've offered 60 parcels. This gets to your ratio question. 22 of those sold, and we have offered some very high value parcels, Lakeshore in northern Minnesota. And you know, I think that we are still experiencing a little bit of a real estate market where folks are looking for kind of a fire sale or a good deal, and we haven't been able to get that in some of those Lakeshore parcels. We did, however, and Mr. Chair, some of your members may know about this. We did, however, sell a 60-acre parcel on Lake Superior that was a very high-value parcel. It was listed for sale at about $800,000, and we sold it for $1.25 million. And we had a lot of competitive bidding on it, and that was a high conservation value as far as being on the lakeshore, very interested parcel for folks, but it wasn't something that the DNR thought that we needed in our portfolio anymore. And so we did put that up for sale and had a lot of success. So be happy to come back, Mr. Chair, and go through even more detail on the sales over the last few years.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Richards. I just want to be clear, you're not taking any land. These are all, there's a seller and there's a buyer. You're the buyer, is that correct?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, in terms of land sales, we are the seller. In terms of land acquisition, certainly, all of our divisions are engaged with land acquisition. The Lands and Minerals Division processes those as the real estate broker.
Representative Hansen, to that point, unlike our own Dakota County, they don't use eminent domain and don't have the authority to use eminent domain to take parkland from private property owners. Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, Director Richards, on that point, you have to follow certain guidelines so you're not having a fire sale. You don't have the discretion because we want to protect the resource of the public investment or the public receipt to those lands, right? There's statutory guidelines that you have to follow so we're not just liquidating the public assets. Is that correct?
Director Richard.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we do have very specific statutory guidelines on how we can sell land and appraise value. We can't just take the lowest bidder.
Good protection of the state money. Good point, Representative Hansen. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Richards, what happens to the proceeds of land sale?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, it depends on the type of land. So if it is school trust land, then the proceeds would go to the school trust corpus. If it is, say, for example, acquired land, then some of those proceeds would go back into the land acquisition account. So it really depends on which type of land sale we're doing. A lot of our land sales have been school trust, and that's what we've been focusing on. We've done a lot of effort on, like I mentioned, trying to identify the highest and best use, and the ones that have identified as real estate, we've been trying to sell for the trust.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So ignoring the school trust sales for now, the other sales, sell a piece of land, you bring in some money, you go out and look for more land.
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, through the strategic land asset management process, if the division that was the manager of that land is seeking to do some acquisition, then we would possibly look at additional acquisition.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. Some of the parcels that DNR receives are gifted to DNR by private persons with some strings attached. Can the DNR sell those after a period of time, or are those in our possession in perpetuity?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, yes. So we have, well, no. So we have different types of land that we get. So if someone gives us a gift, a land gift, often they will ask for a no-sale deed restriction. And so if that is the case and there is a deed restriction put on the land, then we cannot sell it. Not every gift, however, is provided that way.
Follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you. Does the DNR ever refuse to take a gift because of that restriction?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd have to look. I haven't got the details on that right.
Follow-up, Representative
Well, thank you. It just seems that, you know, you've mentioned earlier we get some of these parcels that are in the middle of nowhere, so to speak. Hard to sell, no real value to the state. I'm just cautioning the state to be, you know, judicious about what we accept.
Director Richards, remind us how it works if tax forfeited land, which on the plat map says state of Minnesota, but is managed, if I'm not mistaken, always by the counties. How does that work when that land is sold to, when it goes from public ownership to private ownership?
Mr. Chair, members, so this is one of the activities that we have engaged quite a bit with the counties on, is to identify tax forfeit lands that the counties would like to have sold. And so if those lands are put up for sale, then what those lands would assumingly go into private help holdings, and the revenues from those would go then to distribution to the local governments that revenues from the sale would go to distribution from the local governments that are in the area of the tax forfeit land. The county then would, you know, it would be back on the county tax rolls after that point.
And Director Richards, do you know, and if you don't, if you could provide it to the committee, the breakdown of the percentage of the money, what goes, does none of it go to the state?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd have to get that for you.
Okay. If you could get that, and then also part of that same discussion Representative Torkelson had about where does the money actually flow? Is there an opportunity for some of this money to come back to the general fund if that's where it should go to? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add a comment. I'll try and make folks feel better here. I'm going to get the number of the bill I'm carrying for Beltrami County to sell public land, and I'll make sure everybody has an opportunity to sign on.
Well, and thank you, Representative Purcell. And Representative Purcell is across that northern tier and needs to be part of this discussion also. Director Richards, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see. Just going on to a few more outcomes. At risk of stimulating more questions, Mr. Chair, we also do sales. In addition to sales, we do land exchange. And probably the most significant land exchange in the last year was the Sac Sim Bog land exchange with the Conservation Fund and St. Louis County. It's going to result in the restoration of about 24,000 acres of heavily ditched wetlands being restored to wetlands. At the same time, it's going to provide the school trust more timber, more productive timberlands. And in that situation, we exchanged out 12,600 acres of state land for 5,700 acres. The value ends up being that the trust gets a better value, or gets a good better value than it had for the timber production, but the acreage is a reduction in state land. Lastly, on this slide, you know, Minnesotans care more about what the Division of Lands and Minerals does right now than ever before. And we are taking great efforts to be more transparent and to be more accessible to Minnesotans. And we're real fortunate to have some of the most highly skilled scientists and real estate experts, and, of course, great administrative support.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, Director Richards, I happen to look at your website, the DNR website, and there's land for sale there in Pine County. It's the former St. Croix Boys Camp. I'm just curious to know, how did that wind up in DNR hands? And so now you're selling that.
Mr. Chair, members.
Director Richards.
I'm not in the real estate. It is $296,000, which seems reasonable to me, but I'm kidding.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I'd have to double check on that. I feel like that was a gift. But no, I'm getting a no from Kathy Lewis over there.
Director Lewis, I'm sorry, Director Richard, Ms. Lewis, do you know the answer to that question? I'm not surprised. If you could come down and answer the question, that'd be great. Ms. Lewis, if you could identify yourself for the record and let us know what's behind that parcel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals Division. The St. Croix Boys Camp property was originally acquired forestry land. There was interest in creating a juvenile facility on the property, and it was originally leased to the Wilder Foundation for the what became the St. Croix Boys Camp property. Then, under Governor Rudy Perpich, the property was deeded to the Wilder Foundation for $200,000 with a provision that when they decided to close, the state had the option to exercise the reversion to the state for payment of $200,000. So when the Wilder Foundation closed the property, the DNR exercised that option, and the property became state ownership again, and it is that's why we have it up for sale. We didn't. It's acquired forestry now land in that regard, but we are wanting to sell it, and we have tried that for many years.
Ms. Lewis, is this where the Conservation Corps campers were when the storm came through on July 4th?
Mr. Chair, members, no,
Lewis.
I do not think so.
Okay, thank you. Representative Fabian, additional follow-up? No. Director Richards, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Richards. You mentioned the Sac-Zim Bog, and I'm just wondering, is the DNR working on any other projects where, you know, something will come to us late in the session where it's just an emergency that we have to approve it because it's a once-in-a-lifetime jewel in the crown opportunity, like we were presented with Sac-Zim Bog, and very short notice move through? Is there anything like Sac-Zim Bog coming before us this year?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, not that I'm aware of, that we are doing some work with St. Louis County, Aiken County, and some other counties on sales and exchange related planning, but I don't, a Sac-Zim-like exchange, I'm not aware of one in the works right now.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, just I'm always concerned when we have these immediate requests that we have to do something right away, and then we go out and look at them later and find out discussions have been going on for quite some time, and we just have to do it because it's the last best piece in order to make something happen. So I hope there's not anything else, or if there is, we have a little more lead time to fully explore the ramifications of it.
Thank you. Director Richards, if you can continue, I think you only have two slides left. I'd like you to go through both slides, and we'll see if there's any questions, because I do want to get through forestry for sure today. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to be quick here. And Mr. Chair, I would appreciate a bill someday to keep Kathy Lewis from retiring.
Yeah. Actually, Director Richards, she already can't retire. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just drilling down real quick into what the division does, you can see here on this slide that the majority of the division funding is general fund open, and this is for payment in lieu of taxes. I have a slide after this to talk about that for just a second. So I'm just going to give you a real brief overview of what the division does and how it's funded. So let's first talk about our permitting and regulatory work. We have the mine permitting and coordination section, and also the reclamation and research section. And what these groups do is handle all the permitting and all the coordination with environmental review for permitting of mining. Also, it houses some of our new occupation tax positions, hydrologists, and it also handles things like geochemistry, wetlands, and the research that we do related to mining. Both of these sections are primarily funded through permit fees and to the mining administration account, which comes out of the natural resource fund pie that you see on this slide. And as I mentioned before, there's also occupation tax dollars. There's also funding in terms of research dollars from the general fund, as well as an industry match for some of those research dollars. The next section that we have is our mineral potential section, and this is kind of where our rock hounds reside. And they manage the drill core library, 3 million feet of drill core at the drill core library. They look for aggregate in the state, drill site inspections. A couple things, I've got some props, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. You know, some of you members have probably seen some of these. First of all, hold on one at a time. The first two I want to hand out are a piece of drill core. So this is drill core that's still stored at our drill core library. This is an example from the Duluth complex with copper nickel deposits in it. And then also we have here dimension stones. So this group, our mineral potential group, also looks for dimension stones. And this is actually one that is not being mined, but it is one that we found recently that has potential to be a good dimension stone for countertops and things like that in Lake County. So our mineral potential section is primarily funded through the minerals management account, which again is reflected in the natural resource fund here. There's also some general fund work, general funding for the aggregate work and for the drill core library. We also then have the mine engineering section. This is the group of mine engineers that monitors the development of the existing taconite industry and make sure that the state is properly getting the right amount of royalties for mining of state-owned ore. A couple examples to hand out. So this is a piece of state ore from Hibbing Taconite. In my last committee, someone took my magnet, so I brought one from home. But you can see that there's strands of iron in here, and the magnet will stick to it. This is state. This is school trust ore mined at Hibbing Taconite. And then, of course, the bread and butter of Minnesota mining is taconite pellets. And this is the end product that's shipped out from most of Minnesota's mines, 65% iron content. So the mine engineering section monitors this and, again, collects those royalties. It's also funded by the minerals management account and a small amount of fees and special revenues. Moving to our real estate, we have, again, land acquisition and legal services section. Handles everything that a real estate broker would do for a land acquisition. We also have our legal services related to mining and real estate there. It works closely with our appraisal group. It's almost entirely funded through direct project billing within the DNR. This is considered internal billing for respect of some of the information you guys have in your packet. Our regional operations for real estate are basically our real estate folks that are in each region, and they're responsible for doing all the things that come with all the real estate work that comes with being the largest landowner in the state. And so they are managing leases and trespass, working with the counties. They're our main connection to the counties in the regions, and they also implement our strategic land asset management work. It's primarily funded, this work is funded through service level agreements with the other divisions in DNR, again, special revenues. And there's also $400,000 of general fund that is used for utility license work. And finally, we have our survey section, and our survey section, of course, does surveys for both acquisition and for management of existing lands for trespass issues, again, funded through both professional service billing within the DNR and our service level agreement. When you remove the pass-through monies for PILT and special revenues from mineral leases, the vast majority of lands and minerals budget goes to staffing costs, and we have very little capital expenses. Primarily, it's our Hibbing office and our drill core library. It's one of the best in the nation. I'd encourage you to visit it when you go up to see the Sudan mine. Okay, real quickly on PILT, and Mr. Chair, tell me if you don't want me to go into too much detail on this or not. I can skip past that too.
Director Richards, excuse me, Representative Fabian has a question.
Director Richards, on surveying, you know, there have been some private surveyors that have expressed concern to me, and I know I've talked to Assistant Commissioner Meyer about this, about the bond that's required of private surveyors being at $1 million. It's my understanding that the federal government requires $500,000. The state of North Dakota requires $500,000. Is there any way that we can take a look at that and sync those things up to make it easier for private surveyors to be involved?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, we'll take a look at what our options are there and get back to you on that. Certainly, we are doing a lot more contracting out of our survey work, and it's been a very effective means for us for efficiency and cost, and so we can look at that.
Thank you. Director Richards, in the PILT, if you could just do a high-level overview of how it works, what it is, and maybe you could note that there are different properties get different percentages of PILT paid. Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, you have a fact sheet in your packet about PILT, and this can give you a lot of information on PILT. This slide just basically shows the changes in PILT payments over time. You can see that, let me just step back. PILT is payment in lieu of taxes. It is really the local government aid that's paid to the counties for tax-exempt natural resource land, and it's funded by the general fund. Again, looking at the graph here, you can see there's been a few legislative changes over the years, particularly in 1995, 2001, and 2012, that increased some of the PILT. And then you can also see the box that's labeled County Reassessment of Estimated Market Value of Acquired Lands. So every 6 years, the counties will do a reassessment of the market value, which then affects the PILT payments, and you can see those increases there. Really, the most two significant land types for PILT are DNR administered lands held in fee title and county tax forfeited lands. And I guess just an example of the payments that go for PILT. So if land is acquired from a private landowner, it is paid out at the greater of $5.133 per acre, or 0.75% of the appraised value. And so that appraised value is determined by the estimated market value. And like I said, it's looked at every 6 years by the county. There's other lands in there, Mr. Chair, that are more specific. DNR or county administered tax forfeited lands and other DNR administered lands that are not part of those privately held or privately acquired lands get a rate of $1.50 an acre. And I think the fact sheet lays out a whole bunch of different scenarios. If you'd like me to go through them, I could.
Thank you, Director Richards. Questions? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you remind me, is this carried in our target or is this in the tax committee target? SFIA, is this that's in the tax committee target?
Representative Dill, it is in the tax committee target.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Director Richards, for that. I do encourage members to look at that. That's an important item and comes under a lot of discussion. Continue, Director Richards.
Okay, Mr. Chair, very quickly, these last two slides here. This slide just shows our Game and Fish Fund dollars, which are all used for the land record system, which came online in September 2013. Right now, we're doing some modifications and some enhancements to make sure the system continues to be very usable, and they kind of go to the ongoing maintenance as well. And it also shows the breakdown of the Natural Resource Fund dollars. Again, the majority of those dollars go to the Minerals Management account. There's also, under Mining Administration, mine permit fees, utility license fees, and then, of course, forest management investment is, all, again, for the land record system. So, essentially, I've got one more slide after this, but essentially, for the Lands and Minerals budget proposal for FY16-17, it's to maintain our current level of services. We only have one change item, which I'll talk about in a second. When you add everything up for the biennium, it's about $97 million. About $72 million of that is pass-through money in the form of PILT or special revenues for mineral leases, which means that the division operates for the biennium off of about $25 million. Lands and Minerals is currently staffed at about 90 FTE, down from 103 in 2012. We're a small division, but the work we do is very important, and we're working on some pretty weighty topics, and so maintaining our base is critical to our ability to do that work. Lastly, Mr. Chair, is the one change item that we have is the establishment of a conservation easement stewardship account. And essentially what this would do is generate funds to secure long-term funds for the monitoring of conservation easements to ensure that they are meeting the conservation value that they were acquired for. And it would create this new statutory account. It would seek a contribution to the account on every new conservation easement acquisition. And it would be initially funded through the transfers from the Forest of the Future easement account and then also from the Outdoor Heritage Fund for funds that were established for conservation easement monitoring. It would be managed ultimately by the State Board of Investment, and 5% of those returns would then be used to do the easement management. The change item has an addition of a half FTE. Mr. Chair, that wraps up my presentation, and I'd be happy to take any additional questions.
I don't see any additional questions, Director Richards, but I would like to visit with you on your last proposal specifically. Have you had any conversation, and you can get back to me, on from the Attorney General on the constitutionality of what you're proposing, because it's similar to something that I visited with Representative Dill, Representative Kahn, myself, and others have thought this idea is a good idea. So I find it interesting the department's pursuing it, and thank you for doing that. I think we are wrapped up, and we will hear from forestry next. Thank you, Director Richards and Ms. Lewis. Members, it looks like we'll probably only get through forestry if we're lucky and get started. Assistant Commissioner Meyer will start on the Fish and Wildlife, and then we will continue with that next week. It is my hope that we'll be able to stay on track with all of our budget overviews with the different agencies without having to have evening meetings. That's our hope at this point. Director Bull, welcome back to the committee. Good to see you. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Forrest Bull. I'm the Director of Forestry with the Minnesota DNR, and appreciate the opportunity this morning. What I want to do this morning is talk a little bit about what we do. I want to talk about our budgets and also talk about the change item that we have. So first of all, let me just start out by talking about some of our main responsibilities. One of the main things we do is we put out fires, and these are wildfires. So we suppress those wildfires. Our goal is to keep those fires small through very aggressive initial attack. And as many of you may know, once those fires become larger, they are much more costly and lengthy to put out. We also spend time in pre-suppression, and so I want to talk about suppression, pre-suppression, and prevention a little bit, because this has some impacts on the open appropriation and our direct appropriation from the general fund that I'll talk about in just a few minutes. So the suppression is actually the act of putting those fires out, and also pre-positioning resources in areas that are very likely to have a fire in the with immediate starts. Pre-suppression activities are those that that we do in advance of suppression. So it's recruiting and training employees. It's procuring equipment and supplies, getting equipment under contract, not actually using the equipment yet, but getting it under contract, maintaining, and of course, all our planning activities as well. And then, of course, prevention is really about expanding public awareness about the damages and costs associated with wildfires. And these outreach efforts have created an increased public sentiment against arson and careless burning. So we think that is very important, too. The other big piece of what we do in our division, so it's really fire and timber, and with a lot of other things to go along. But the other big piece is timber management. Of course, we manage the state's timber resources, covering the 4.2 million acres. Our goal is to offer 800,000 cords of wood annually. We provide about 30% of the state's fiber to the Minnesota's forest industry, and that industry provides over 62,000 jobs and has an overall benefit of more than $16 billion to the state. So very important work that we do there. Timber harvesting is one of our only and extremely important management tools. It allows us to manage state forest lands effectively. Timber harvest actually mimics natural disturbances that forests used to experience, like the large wildfires of the past. But it also helps us to efficiently and effectively manage those forests, maintain them very in a healthy state, provide resilience, and also helps with climate change. So really wanting to make those forests productive. Along with that, we do forest inventory. And, of course, all management of our forests starts with a very solid and timely inventory data. This is really an accurate on-the-ground picture of what we have as a state to work with, and really allows us to make sound management decisions.
Director Bull, excuse me. Representative Halston has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the managing state forests for, and then you list clean water, wildlife habitat, quality, timber, outdoor recreation, biological diversity, are those prioritized if one competes with another in terms of interest? Do you have do you prioritize those?
Director Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, those are not prioritized in any order. We try to sustainably manage our forests for multiple benefits.
Representative Hausman.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. But suppose the two interests conflict at some point. Do you have to raise the issue within your department of priority?
Director Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman. We do work with all of our divisions, interdisciplinary teams, and when someone brings issues to the team, we try to come to a resolution. Certainly at some point we have to make a decision and move on, but we try to prioritize all of these multiple benefits and manage our lands in a sustainable fashion.
Representative Hausman.
Well, I'll give him a for instance. So, for instance, if quality timber management suddenly conflicts with clean water.
Director Bolt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman. Quality timber management produces clean water. Our studies have shown that as we manage forests, we manage for multiple benefits. And to have a healthy forest also provides these other benefits. Healthy forests mean good wildlife habitat. Healthy forests mean clean water.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Heinzman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Director Bow, I have the opportunity to spend some time up near Bearhead State Park, and just had a couple questions. Number one, I really like some of the logging that has been done there, and it, I think, has been a great benefit to the area. I did notice a number of months ago that in a particular logging site, they had been pulling slash to a pile, and then after a number of years, it had been and it was ignited and burnt. And I was just wondering, in regard to best logging practices and some of the tools that folks are using, is that fairly common still to pull slash to a location and burn it, or are we moving more towards allowing that slash to fall directly to the ground and be crushed by equipment and such?
Director Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heisman, it depends, and it depends on the species you're trying to grow on that site. I think what you're talking about is maybe that was a pine site. You were trying to get rid of a lot of the slash. It's part of how we prepare the site for a planting. Other species, for instance, aspen, you wouldn't move things to the center and burn it. You'd let that slash lie on the ground, and because that species stump sprouts, and when you're planting pine, you really have to kind of disturb the site. You want to ruffle up the soil and, you know, maybe get more of that slash off to the side or disposed of.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bow, in this particular case, the fire that was ignited to consume that debris got out of control and burnt several acres along with the slash pile. And that was a sort of a frustrating result of that. And then also, and I understand your comment. That does make sense, the different species. I get that. But I guess the follow-up question to that would be, in the case of a situation where there is a subsequent fire, or in some cases where there is controlled burns and sort of a sort, what is the science, give me an update, what is the science in regard to the possible release of mercury if the fire gets hot enough?
Director Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, that is out of my area of expertise, but I could certainly find an answer and get back to you.
That would be good, Director Bull. And then I think with this committee has a number of new members and with interest in your division, so I think we'll maybe have to have a tour this summer. And some of my best experiences members have been in different tours where we tour forestry and the equipment today and the different practices. I'm just thinking of, you know, selective clearing, you know, clearing at all, clear cutting and pine, aspen, different than whether you naturally revegetate or it's planted or aerial planted. There's really a lot of cool stuff going on, and to see it and what they're doing. In some cases, the slash goes off to biomass burning. What I see more and more, and I think this is Representative Heinzman's point, that oftentimes the slash is just left right on the forest floor to give us good compost and stuff. So I think we'll have to have a tour and get up in God's country, as they call it up north. That'll be good. Continue on.
Mr. Chair, we'd love to put on the tour for you. Look forward to it. Love to put on the tour for you. Look forward to it. So. Talked about forest industry or inventory, I'm sorry. Another thing we do is we have state forest roads. We have a system of roads out in our state forest, over 2,300 miles. That road system provides access for recreation, general public use. In some cases, those folks out there are using our forest roads to get to work or get to town. Also, those roads are certainly used by us for fire protection and forest management and for timber production as well. These roads are really important for the state's tourism industry. They really provide access to the forest for all the hunting and hiking and bird watching and all of those kinds of things. Another big part of our job is to do reforestation and silviculture work, and we reforest about 11,500 acres annually by either aerial seeding or by hand planting seedlings. And then another 30 to 35,000 acres are allowed to grow back naturally, and that's mainly how we regenerate aspen. We have to determine reforestation methods based on the species that's best for the site. So if pine is best, we plant seedlings. If black spruce is best, we do aerial seeding. And again, if aspen is best on that particular site, we would just allow that to regenerate.
Excuse me, Director. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bowe. I don't know if this is the right time to ask the question, but actually to bring up the point, you know, we're reading a lot about the climate change impacting the forest, and I would think it'd be beneficial for us to learn about that impact. You talk about aspens, or I'm reading are threatened, and I'm wondering about the red pine, and I wonder if there's an opportunity to learn about that, if it's appropriate today or at another time.
You mentioned it in passing, Director Bull, but maybe you could give some specific examples where you've changed maybe some species, how far south or how far north, depending on the reverse effect of some of what's actually happening.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. We have not moved species around the state. We think that having a healthy forest is a resilient forest, and also a forest that has a good mixture of species. We know from studies that some species in the future are going to be winners, and some species in the future will likely be users. But at this point, we're not moving things from Iowa or farther south but into Minnesota. We're just looking at this climate change. We do think about it as we make that next prescription for a particular stand, but not fully moving species from one part of the state to another.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this somewhat follows up, but it's a little different topic, if that's okay, Mr.
Go ahead, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Bowe, so you know, most of what you've been talking of have been the northern forests, but the hardwood forests seem to have some pressure as well, and particularly along the blufflands, along the river, and those oaks don't grow back as fast, and they're often on steep slopes. So what is the DNR's approach, particularly when you look along the Mississippi Corridor or in the Richard J. Doar forests? What do you see on the lands that you own there for the hardwoods that are being harvested?
Director Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we've done a lot of work to reestablish our oak in those southern forests. This is all part of our silviculture work, of course, which we've been talking about for the last couple minutes. And I think our staff, along with the university, is really done a lot of work to better treat our oak stands. And you know, they're using a variety of tactics to regenerate that oak. But probably one of the kind of interesting things is they actually go in and plant oak ahead of time prior to a harvest. And one of the reasons is we know that oak, as we plant that seedling, it's not one of those that springs up right away. It sits in the ground for a year or so, and if we can get it planted ahead of time, prior to doing the harvest, it actually shoots up much better and you get much greater regeneration. The other thing that we're finding is, you know, we do have a good oak resource, but maybe in certain parts we've been holding that oak a little long. So as oak is held 200 years or so, you cut it and it doesn't resprout. So we need to have that in the mix as well. Sometimes we hold on the landscape too long, and so a little bit more aggressive harvest in certain areas on certain types actually regenerates better.
Follow-up, Senator Hansen.
And finally, and this may, you know, looking at the diseases that may be impacted with climate disruption, but with oak wilt, we've had that around for a while, and just wondering how we're doing with that in terms of, we know the emerald ash borer has been going to be impacting the ash amount, but it seems like we have a number of these diseases that are coming. Oak wilt's one. What other ones do we see coming?
Director Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, certainly oak wilt is still on the landscape, and it's moving farther north. We find a lot of it up in that Anoka Sand Plain area and now farther even, so we're certainly concerned about that. We've got gypsy moth quarantines in the state now. We know the issues with emerald ash borer, and it just seems like we're in this cycle of more and more invasives coming and more threats to our overall forest resources.
Thank you, Director Bull. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bull, thanks for being here. On the LUP lands up in the Beltrami Island State Forest, can you tell me what the management plan is for the red pine, or what we refer to as Norway pine?
Director Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the LUP lands are actually managed by the Division of Wildlife. And we work with them closely. We do the timber management on that land for them, but they do have kind of their own plan for those lands and those stands. They do come up on our annual plan cut list, and so we work with them on the ultimate management of those lands. But they do fall under our overall state forest resource management plans, but they have specific plans on what they want to accomplish. And those lands are more focused on wildlife enhancements and management. And that's their primary goal for those lands.
Director Bulk, remind us of the acronym that you and Representative Fabian are using.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Land Utilization Program. Those are actually federal lands that are managed or leased to the state and leased to the department, managed by the Division of Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would be interested, Mr. Chair, then on making sure that we get some sort of report from wildlife on the management plan there, but I would also encourage, you know, forestry and wildlife to work together to, you know, manage them well, I'm just going to say. We'll leave it at that, and we'll let members decide what well means in the future.
Thank you, Representative Fabian, and I think Mr. Rivers caught your question, and Fish and Wildlife will also give their spin on that when they come back. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Vo, one more question about what I'm reading. Maybe I could get lost in what I'm reading, but about 10 or 15 years ago, the DNR was encouraging, at least where I farm in Wadena County, the removal of jack pine. And now I'm reading that there's a renewal of interest in jack pine. And has the policy for as approach to managing the jack pine, has it changed? And if so, why?
Director Bolt. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure if the policy for jack pine has changed, but we try to look at the actual site and look at the soils, look at the plants that are there, and determine what is this site going to grow the best. Does it grow? Will it grow jack pine best? Will it grow red pine best? And so really have the site tell us. And I'll talk in a couple minutes, hopefully, about our ecological classification system and how we make some of those determinations. Certainly, jack pine is very marketable, and it has good wildlife values as well.
And Representative Johnson, in one of the tours I was on, I always thought, I don't know why we plant jack pine. All I ever see is how lousy they do. And Director Bro, I can't remember where, but we had a tour somewhere in Minnesota, and I don't remember which one it was on. your people pointed to jack pine stands that were phenomenal, and I never knew you could grow them in Minnesota. And the local forester said it's all about where it's at specifically, but they're beautiful, and I never knew they could grow like that. Continue on, Director Bolt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on, we talked in the questioning a little bit about forest health. That is another area where we spend considerable time. Of course, we our part in there is to help address pest outbreaks and emerging threats to the counties and private lands and to our state forests. We also have a program that is all about outreach. It's called Play Clean Go. You may have seen some of the billboards along the highways. It's engaging residents and recreationalists and businesses in a campaign to stop the spread of invasive species. We also have forest certification in Minnesota. We maintain forest certification on 5 million acres, so it's just not our state forest acres, but also the wildlife acres in the state. This means that these lands are recognized as being well managed by a set of standards and using third parties to take a look at those stands, inspect those stands, both from the Forest Resources Council and the Sustainable Forest Initiative. So third-party certification that our forests are in good shape. And finally, we do provide outreach and technical assistance. We help communities and private landowners through some training sessions and other materials and encourage them to keep their forests and lands healthy. I want to talk about our existing or our budget, and this, of course, this includes the governor's recommendation. I do have a slide later that talks specifically about the initiative. What I want to point out on this slide, my colors are different than yours, so it threw me off for a second. Sorry. What I wanted to point out on this slide is that 16%. Of our budget is in the general fund open emergency firefighting appropriation. And these funds are used for pre-suppression and suppression activities that I talked about before. The amount used each year out of that open appropriation fluctuates depending on the fire activity and how severe of a fire season we have. For example, in fiscal year 12, we used $17 million. In fiscal year 13, which was a very severe fire season, we used $23 million. And last year, fiscal year 14, fairly mild season, we used $15 million out of there. We work with MMB to determine or when we need to use that open appropriation to pay for our firefighting expenses. And every year, we supply a report on our firefighting expenditures, both in the open and in the direct, and that report is due on January 15th of each year, and we had, of course, just submitted our report, I guess, a couple of weeks ago. So this report was delivered to all the appropriate chairs and is also here in the reference library.
Thank you. Continue, Director Bolt.
The area of the other area of general funds is our direct appropriation. So 41% of our budget is in the direct appropriation. Of that, still an additional $14.2 million is for fighting wildfires. This is used for all three firefighting or fire expenditures, being prevention, pre-suppression, and suppression. In addition to that, out of the general fund, we passed through $580,000 to the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. Their responsibilities include in advising the governor, legislature, and public agencies on current and future forest issues and how to retain jobs and create jobs for the forest products industry. The council also evaluates and improves forest management guidelines that both public and private entities use, and Forest Council also updates the forest landscape plans that are mandated by the legislature. The rest of the general fund is used for our division, for all of the things that I had talked about before for timber management, silviculture, forest certification, and for forest health. The next biggest block on there is the Natural Resources Fund, and the majority of these dollars come from timber sales, and this is called the Forest Management Investment Account. And again, those dollars are collected from the harvest of timber, and we use those dollars to manage our timber for road maintenance, for forest improvement activities, and silviculture. Another piece of the pie up there is our special revenue funds, and the majority of these dollars are received for providing out-of-state firefighting and aircraft and equipment. So we actually get reimbursed, and this is a revolving account. So we spend out of this account when folks go out-state, and then we get reimbursed from those other entities that we go help. Also included in the special revenue fund is gas tax dollars that are allotted to the division for our work on forest roads. We get about $1 million annually, and we split that with the counties that have forest roads as well. Federal funds, we get federal funds for a variety of things. We get some federal funds for forest stewardship, again for fire prevention. We get some federal funds for some small urban and community forestry projects, and also some forest health projects that the federal government helps out with, specifically aerial detection and some on-the-ground monitoring research projects. These federal dollars do fluctuate. We've had forest legacy dollars coming to us in the past, but again, not much in that particular area. The other dollars, this includes dollars from the Heritage Enhancement Account and the Game and Fish Fund, and this is for our work in managing terrestrial invasive species and our work connected to the ecological classification system, which is really about identifying and mapping the native plant communities.
Director Bolt, Representative Fabian has a question, and then after that question, I'm going to have you walk through the last couple slides, and then we'll take questions at the end to be sure you get through. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bolt, on the gas tax, you said you get about $1 million. Is that per year or per biennium? I just want to be clear.
Director Bolt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's $1 million per year, and we give 50% of that to the counties that have forest roads.
Thank you.
Continue, Director Bull.
I think I can be brief on this slide. I talked about the Game and Fish Fund and how we use those funds for managing terrestrial invasive species and our work connected to the ecological classification system. The Natural Resources Fund is just a little bit more detailed there. Again, this is our forest management account. It comes to us from the timber revenue that's collected. And the miscellaneous and other are some other funds that we bring in through the sale of balsam boughs and the sale of, or the money we collect for burning permits and some land sales and cooperative agreements, those kinds of things. On to the change item request. The change item really focuses on three main areas. One is state land management, the second is forest health, and the third is technology improvements. So under state land management, the first thing is that this investment provides continuing funding to return to our desired 20-year inventory cycle. And what we're talking about here is visiting stands once every 20 years to determine the age, the composition, and the health of that stand. We have, again, 4.2 million acres to look after, and we want to make sure that we have a good inventory so that we can manage our lands appropriately. And so this is a very, very important piece of our work. Secondly, this allows us to increase our stand treatments for long-term economic gain. Again, these stand treatments include activities like thinning, removal of vegetation, removal of undesirable species. It helps the stand grow healthy and strong and continually gain economic value. This initiative also allows us to do a better job on our roads. We have a large road system. These roads need continual repair, maintenance, and about 90% of the forest road traffic is actually recreational use. So it benefits, our roads benefit a lot of folks. The next category is forest health, and I mentioned some of the things that we do in forest health. This increase would allow us to increase our monitoring and response efforts by evaluating forest health and assessing the potential for pest outbreaks using inventory and remote sensing data. It also provides more on-the-ground assistance to land managers, so these forest health folks would help our foresters, help county foresters or city foresters with the pest outbreaks, and of course also helps advise private landowners when they have to deal with these things to either prevent the establishment or reduce the impact of these invasive species. In addition to that, we would use some of these dollars to monitor and treat invasive species on state lands. As you know, buckthorn and other invasive species are really prominent on the landscape now, and this would help protect our economic investment that we have in our forests. It would continue to create good recreational values that we all enjoy, and it helps to diversify the plant and animal life that exists on those stands. And finally, in the area of technology improvements, this funding would provide an improved forestry data management. This was brought to our attention in the recent legislative auditor's report on forest DNR forest management. And I'll just put a plug in. If this is available online and also from the legislative auditor, we were very pleased with the report. It's a very detailed report. It's really the nuts and bolts of how we operate, why we do what we do, and how we do it sustainably. And it talks about budget issues and a variety of things. But I would encourage if anyone has interest in the forestry area, this is a great resource. So plug for that. But the auditor's report did confirm that the division systems, the computer systems, are antiquated and in need of some repair. And so the technology improvements will certainly allow us to do that. We also know that the technology improvements allow us to have a much leaner workforce, and we have become much leaner over the years. So with that, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Director Bolt.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question. You said that, did you say 90% of the forest roads are used for recreation? Could you just describe what that looks like? What kind of recreational driving are we talking about?
Director Bolt.
Mr. Chair, members, well, we've done some surveys of road counts and who's using our state forest roads. And what we're finding is it's recreational users. So it's the hikers, the bird watchers, the hunters. It's people that are enjoying the outdoors, folks that are berry picking, all of that large group of recreational users are the 90% of the use on our roads.
Follow up, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like a broad group of people. I'm wondering, do you break it down at all in any way?
Director Bolt.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that data with me, and I don't believe we broke it down further. We really wanted to look at the use on our roads, and it was more recreational, transportation for industry, and that's how we broke it out.
Thank you.
And Director Bo, for members, these are the gravel dirt roads that maybe once in two decades they'll actually have the heavy use of the cutting of the trees and the removal of the trees, or, you know, if it's clear cut, whatever. But, and that's, they're established for
that purpose, certainly, but in the interim, every year in the summer, it's the berry pickers and bird watchers and campers, and in the fall, the hunters, and sometimes they have access to lakes and such. So it's good for folks to know, because the pressure is to keep those roads so they're passable for the large log trucks, but we as recreational users are the winners in getting to use them. So it's a good thing. I'm sorry, Representative Dill. I knew I had another question. Representative Dill.
Thank you. Two things. So 13 years on this committee, I've seen the budget going up and down. Number of foresters in the woods, not in the woods. Industry clamoring for wood. Industry too much wood. And I sense that we're like hugely deficit or deficient compared to where we were in about, pick a number, 2008. How can you continue to manage the forest and keep it healthy, keep wood in front of industry, satisfy all of the users that are not related to cutting and managing forests on the kind of money you're getting?
Director Bowe, you got to be real quick on that one. I have two short questions after that. Director okay. Bowe, sorry, Representative Dill.
That's all right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, thank you for the question. To put things in perspective, in 2008 and 9 biennium to the 2016-17 biennium of what this budget is proposing. Even with the governor's recommendation, we're $12 million less in this biennium than we were in the 2008-09 biennium.
Follow up, Representative Dill.
The point I'm making is that I've got a plant that is one of the most sophisticated board plants in the country sitting idle. And one of the reasons they're sitting idle is because the wood's not getting put up and there aren't loggers anymore to cut them because they all went out of business. And we got a bad situation. Second question, and this is maybe not, this is in your area, I think. I recently got a communication from the department about how that they were going to make an attack on deer stands in the woods because the cutting of shooting lanes so that deer can be shot. You know, Director Bowe, we talk about all these recreational users in the woods, and we need the deer hunting, but we're not giving you enough money to cut down the wood. You got more wood falling down in the wood than all the deer hunters in the United States could cut in one season for deer lanes. You're going to run into some serious issues if the Department of Forestry starts encouraging wildlife to take down deer stands because they're cutting some shooting lanes. Plus, I think we have something over 5 inches you can't cut it anyway. So I think that's appropriate. So think as that moves forward, because it's already got Northeast Minnesota stirred up.
And it's not only stirred up in Northeast Minnesota, it's quite broad-based, Director Bowe, and I'm going to ask Fish and Wildlife to address that. So if you've got thoughts, if you could let Director Bogus know your thoughts on that issue, Director Bowe. I'm going to real quickly, Representative Fisher, you had a question.
Yes, thank you. I'll try to be very quick, Mr. Chair. The question I have is on from our timberlands that you manage, what percentage of the wood that is used in the state is coming from public lands? And then also, as I hear the more stories of private companies selling off their lands, does that eventually reduce the forest lands out there and put pressure on the timber industry long term if those lands go from forest to something else?
Director Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, thank you for the question. The department manages about 24% of Minnesota's forest land. We provide about 30% of the overall fiber for the industry. So we think we are certainly doing our share. And back to Representative Dill's question, we put up about 800,000 cords a year, which we feel is a sustainable amount for the state. And we have prioritized that work. That is the most important work that we do. Through the years, we have reduced other activities. Our private forest management work, we reduced that program by 80% over the years. So we've really prioritized our work to manage our own timberlands.
Director Bo, I anticipate we're going to be bringing forestry back when we discuss water appropriation permits and some of the conversion that's taken place. So, Representative Fisher, we will be hearing about that issue. It's a concern for a number of us. Representative Torkelson, if you could note your question quickly.
Very briefly, Chair, just a request for information. How much wood is burned in wildfires versus how much is burned for home heat?
Director Bo, if you could get back to us on that, and we're expecting you're going to know exactly. Members, we're adjourned.